Okay, the midterm has been great. It is being graded. I have solutions made up, but I have a couple of people who are sick who want to take it. And so, and also, I really have other material I need to cover. So, we'll talk about that in a week. So, hopefully, when I return the midterms, they're making good progress. So, assignment 3 is mostly up right now. We should talk dates on when that should be, but let's talk about that at the end of class for reasons that will become clear if you look at it. So, intrusion detection. How much have I talked about this so far in this class? I don't believe I have. Yes? Oh, note. Who's taking notes? Okay. I specifically have been avoiding talking about intrusion detection because this is considered to be one of my areas of expertise. This is like, and intrusion detection is what I'm known for. And basically my plan is to spend the rest of class talking about this. The rest of the semester talking about this because it's a significant topic. I think it's very important and I think it's underappreciated. And hopefully, I will give you all some insight into it because I could spend a lot of time talking to you about malware detection, I could talk to you all about access control, I could talk to you all about firewalls, talk to you about cryptography. The trouble is, I don't believe in any of that stuff. I actually believe in intrusion detection. And the other stuff doesn't do anything. They do things, but there's certain fundamental limitations to what they can do. And that's what I want to talk about. So the first thing I have to distinguish is what the problem is that intrusion detection is addressing. So intrusion detection is easy to confuse with anti-malware. These are not the same thing. Although, but the line is not, there's a bit of fuzziness. And the reason is anti-malware is designed to stop malware. Intrusion detection is designed to detect an intrusion prevention system designed to prevent intrusions. So malware is just a malicious program. An intrusion may involve malicious code, but it may not. The easiest way to see the difference between these things is, let's say you're doing industrial espionage. And you want to find out the secret plans for some new product that's coming out from a competitor. So let's put aside ethics and everything else. Let's assume you have been given the task of finding out what those plans are. One way to do this would be to infect the target systems with some malware, which would then allow you to remote desktop into the system and then look around. Right? That's one way. You might send them an email with a malicious attachment or with a link that they click on it, or maybe it's a drive-by download or something, but some way to infect them with the malware. But that's not your only way you can do it. You could also just try to get someone's password and maybe guess them. Maybe you set up some service that you know employees at the place use. And they sign up for accounts. And then you know their corporate credentials because their name and stuff, and you just try the passwords they tried on your other site. And a lot of times people will use the same password for both. And so you're in.
I was gonna say if they have a Wi-Fi network there, you could physically go there and make a man-in-the-middle network, a honeypot.
There's many ways of coming. I say, well, Yeah, there's lots of ways of potentially getting the password. I'm saying, but or you could even call up the help desk and say, you know, I really need to reset my password because, you know, I just did this. And you know, you probably social engineer them into getting the password reset, depending on how good you are at it. So then you're an attacker. You have a password. You can just go on in and look around. Now notice the difference is that the attacker's goals have not changed. All that changes is the means. And so anti-malware is one particular means. In full, intrusion detection should actually try to deal with the goals that the attacker has. It's like they're coming into your system and doing stuff. We're going to stop them. Or at least going to detect them, and then ideally we're going to stop them. So at first glance, you'd be going like, whoa, that seems crazy, you know, as a problem area. It's like, wait, malware, okay, it's malicious code. Now, I went through this whole rant on what one person's malicious, another person's not malicious, and that the line between those two is not clear. But with intrusion detection, it's like, what's an intrusion? What's someone breaking in? How does it mean an unauthorized user? I mean, if they're using things that definitely break system, security mechanisms, okay, maybe you can detect them. But what if they're breaking no mechanisms? They've just bypassed your security. Yeah. So that's, imagine if someone managed to get the system administrator's credentials for the system. Now they can go around just changing accounts or maybe even just create an entire new account for them to do their work. How do you deal with that? Well, the lofty goal of intrusion detection is to deal with that problem. To that end, there are three basic approaches to intrusion detection. One is signature-based. Specification-based and then generally you have them either as host or network. Or Heiser. So you have signature, specification, anomaly detection types of intrusion detection. And then you have host-based intrusion detection, network-based intrusion detection, and hybrid, which kind of mixes the two. So you can connect the things to make various kinds between those two. But let's talk first about, really, all the net host versus network just says it's determining what information it's looking at. Is it looking at behavior on the host? So this means typically you have some sort of agent running on the host. This looks kind of like an anti-malware application, which is watching various things on the host and trying to detect intrusions. Network-based means it's looking at network traffic and trying to see if you can detect an intrusion there. And then a hybrid, of course, mixes the two. But for these, what's the difference between these things? You know, first thing, it's what it looks like. You have a signature, you have a specification, or you're doing something with anomalies. So, signature. What do you think that is?
That has to do with encryption?
This signature, you're right, that it's funny, you don't think about these name collisions unless you talk to someone who isn't familiar with the area. So signature here is talking about signature as in pattern, as in think regular expressions. So the idea here is whatever you want, whatever the attack is, you have a signature for it. So for example, if there is a worm that's going around on the network that's spraying from machine to machine, you could have a signature that would detect the particular bytes and the packets associated with that. And so a network-based intrusion detection system would say, oh, wow, we got some malware running on your network. You might go, well, didn't that sound like anti-malware? Well, traditionally, anti-malware is a host-based thing. When you put it on the network, you kind of call it signature-based intrusion detection. Because, of course, also part of the thing is, you know, on a host, it will actually normally detect and block it. On the network, you're not necessarily sure if the pattern matches. So you're generating alarms, traditionally. I mean, normally you don't have... So that's a fundamental thing with intrusion detection, is normally you do not have enough confidence in your answers to be able to completely block the threat. Because you're dealing with this fundamentally more amorphous thing of an intrusion, as opposed to a piece of malware. It's like, oh, that's malware, that is bad. Versus someone broken into that account is using it to steal corporate secrets. Maybe they just are working on a big project. How do you tell the difference? We'll get to that. But it's, so signature-based means, think regex. Traditionally, this is on networks to look for bad packets. Specification-based means you have a specification of behavior. But the specification is not of the attacker. The specification is of the regular system. So in our terminology of whitelist, blacklist, signatures define a blacklist. Specifications define a whitelist. So this is what should be happening on the system. So if something happens that's not supposed to be happening on the system, you know that something bad is happening. Then what's anomaly detection?
Is that based on user behavior? Like if it deviates from...
We'll get to that.
It's like defining statistical models for activity profile behavior. And then you kind of just...
That's part of it, yes. That's one way of doing it. That's one aspect of it. There's a lot to talk about, but you're definitely getting at the idea of things. Yeah.
Abnormal behavior, like accessing an account like at 3 a.m. in the morning.
Right. So an anomaly detection is about normal versus abnormal. So you have some way of detecting, this is an anomaly. This does it, and so this is weird. Maybe it's a bad guy. I mean, this is the classic thing people do when they go like, I think my computer is infected with malware. Why is it? It's running slow and crashing. Could you have a bad driver? You know, could be a bad driver or something like that. I mean, but it could be malware. But again, people are thinking about this because they notice something's weird about their computer. People do this automatically. You can't prevent people from detecting weird things. You know, what are conspiracy theories? You know, people connecting the dots in all kinds of weird ways. That's essentially what anomaly detection is the weirdness. Now, there are people who will talk about anomaly detection using signatures, such as saying, oh, we have, you know, someone is logging in at 3 a.m. and people should only be working from 9 to 5. So that's an alarm. If you do something on time, that's a signature. If you're doing anomaly detection, this implies something adaptive. Something where you are basing it on observation. Anomaly detection is not about, I mean, notice, both of these, so signatures is based on, okay, I have a pattern of bad things. I know that bad thing, I'll write a pattern for it, and that's how I'll recognize it. Specification, I have a pattern of good things, which I will handcraft. And that will be you know, what my system is allowed to do, whether my individual host, even a program, or an entire network. Anomaly detection, you're baselining. You may be getting statistical information or other kinds of machine learning or something, where you're learning how the system behaves, and then after you learned it, you then can detect deviations. So implicitly, there's always some notion of training with anomaly detection. So, which of these do you think I'm most interested in?
The third.
Yeah. This is my claim to fame, is anomaly detection. So, and if you, this makes sense, because remember I was talking about the biology stuff? That's how I got into this mess. Was what you look at when I talk about the immune system and noticing when a cell is behaving unusually with those weird protein fragments and stuff like that, the immune system is doing anomaly detection. It trained the cells, it trained the population, and has to empirically adjust its model and then reacts to deviations. And it's an imperfect mechanism. That's what drew me into the computer security field. But first, we're going to spend most of our time talking about this. Before we talk about that, though, let's talk a bit about this. Why are these problematic in fundamental ways?
Because you can always...
Well, start with one.
Well, with signature-based stuff, you can always change your signature.
So there's variation, that's kind of part of it.
It's a blacklist, so it has to be known before.
Right. So specifically, it's a blacklist. It's a blacklist of all the badness in the world. Does that list ever stop growing? No. So first off, so signatures. So it's unbounded. You could have, there's no limit to the number of signatures you can produce. Great business model, by the way. You know, you gotta keep updating your signatures. You know, oh, there's some new stuff. Great business model. Subscriber, you're out of date. But it's worse than that. So it's unbounded size. You're only going to catch known attacks. Now, you may add some generalization into your signature to say, oh, we can detect these variations on the bad thing, but you're fundamentally limited in how much you can generalize. Because you have to make sure the rule doesn't match legit behavior under any circumstances. So you only get known attacks. It's unbounded in size, and it's easily evaded, because those signatures, you vary your approach somehow, and you'll break the signature. And again, the defender is limited because they have to make sure the signature generates few false positives. So, you know how what happens in practice with intrusion detection systems, with signature-based intrusion detection, it's actually kind of funny. You get a huge list of signatures, which you put them into any real network, because we're only talking about signature-based network, we're talking about network intrusion detection. You put it into a network,
nothing works.
Well, what does it do? It generates a huge list of alarms. Because they've got lots of signatures, and some of those signatures will match the traffic in your network. Just always. So you know what you have to do? you have to adjust your signatures. You have to, like, either remove them, prune the ones that generate too many alarms, and in order to get down to the ones that will, so basically to lower your false positive rate. But it's like, wait, I thought the whole point was to have low false positives. So it's almost like by construction you say, well, signatures only work if it has low false positives, right? Then you're using practice like, well, I don't have low false positives. Well, adjust it till you do. What? So, and the benefit of doing this, removing the signatures that trigger on your regular traffic, you still are only getting known attacks. And you and they can still get around them. So, what have you won? I mean, it's really, this is not that different from anti-malware systems. In the sense of, the attackers can't evade it, but it makes make sure that the canned off-the-shelf attacks won't work against you.
Signature-based stuff is also used often for cheat detection, I've found.
That's interesting. Cheat detection is really intrusion detection, but it's you messing with the game binary, and so it's more in a host-based. But it's using signatures,
and it wouldn't be known because nobody's writing their own cheats. They're all.
That's true. Very few people create their own cheats. It's mostly using standard off-the-shelf cheats. So it actually can work because they're now, and that's why anti-malware scanners have some values, because it basically prevents you from using off-the-shelf stuff. Yes.
I'm just gonna mention there are cheats that that they automatically change their signatures every time you run it.
Yeah. They try at least.
I'm just wondering, how would a signature generate a false positive if you added it to the list because you deemed it to be malicious?
The question is, who added it to the list? The vendor added it to the list. And then the person who bought it puts it on their network and they go, well, they thought it was malicious, but that's perfectly legit on our network. You know, you basically have, it generates all these alarms. You go like, well, that's our in-house application that's triggering it. So, you know, they go like, well, we didn't have that application to test against, so we didn't realize that signature trigger on it, but now you have to go through and disable those things. Because they have remember, there's a lot of signatures. That's how they show their value. There's a lot of rules. And you have to go through and prune it. There's some tools and things to help automate it, automatically do the pruning, but it's just, you should see like, okay, what value are you getting out of it?
But it'd still be a good first defense, right? Against, like, making this up, I'd say 80% of wannabe attackers or infiltrators.
So the thing to understand with every defense is not just that you can't only look at the attacks it will prevent. You have to look at the entire cost of having the defense. Every defense imposes overhead, somehow. Maybe it's runtime overhead, maybe it's a reduction in usability, maybe it's a reduction in throughput. You know, it's like there's always ways it's going to impact you. And so the question is with this is, what's the impact of this? It's like, in practice, what it tends to be is, you often are getting a lot of false positives, because you haven't tuned your signatures. And in that case, you either have to spend a lot of time tracking down, like, oh, it generated an alarm, what happened? Or you spend the time tune it, and that's another investment of time. And then maybe you think, okay, that's now running, you think you're protected, but actually it's missing huge numbers of things. So it's, and it's still generating the alarms. So, if this never generated any false alarms, and it just sort of sits there quietly and runs, then it's like, great. But that's never the case. So deploying it means now you've got to listen to it crying wolf. And no, maybe it provides benefit, but the fact is that even in the best case scenario, you're still only dealing with the things people already have signatures for. And normally if you're deployed to the network, it's for an enterprise, and the attackers you're going to deal with will often be, how does this cover someone stealing a password? How do you write a signature for someone stealing a password? You don't, because it could have happened completely somewhere else. You then have to maybe make a signature of, oh, what's a way in which our internal business processes can be abused? What do those signatures even look like? You can in principle write them, and most of these signature-based systems give you ways to write your own signatures. But what do they look like?
Now, if you were doing something geographic to filter that, would that be more of an anomaly detection, or would that still be a signature?
So, depends on how you do the location. I mean, if you have a whitelist of like, okay, these are the locations that are allowed, that's more of a specification. If you say, oh, you know, if it's from Iran or North Korea or something, okay, that's a blacklist. You know, because a lot of things are saying, okay, here are these export control countries, you're not allowed to send things to them, so okay, they're off. And then there's but then also there could be, well, let's look at where our people normally go, let's learn it, and then that would be more anomaly detection. So most particular types of defenses you can do in one of, you know, using all these things depending upon how you frame it. And there's what's in practice. I mean, in practice, signature-based systems are used for their strength, which is, okay, I've got a bunch of malware that I know has this expression on the wire, or I have these known attacks on web, you know, let's say you have running a WordPress installation. You know that WordPress can attack with this kind of scripts or something, you know. So you might say, well, why don't you just patch your software? Well, a lot of times in large environments, in production environments, they don't want to patch their software. Because patching the software could result in downtime, it could result in systems, you know, not working with internal modifications, you know, there's all kinds of problems that can arise from updating software from upstream sources. So in those sort of environments, they might say, well, I can't patch it, but maybe I can make a signature for attacks that would exploit that vulnerability. And so you add that to there, and that can, you know, help protect you against those particular attacks. So that's not, you know, that is definitely not no zero value, but there's a limit, a fundamental limitation in what it's doing. When you look at security, when someone says there's a limitation, that doesn't mean the approach is bad. It means they're being honest, because all approaches have limitations. There's no such thing as the silver bullet that takes care of everything. And I'm saying, this is very, if you know what's coming at you, this can stop it. And sometimes you know what's coming at you, and sometimes this is the only way you're going to be able to get a heads up. And maybe if you actually know exactly what it is, you can just block every network connection that matches this. Now, of course, the whole doing this at the network level with everything getting encrypted is making this very, very difficult, unless you're just knowing certain hosts shouldn't be talked to. Now, specification-based, entirely different animal, but somehow similar. So the theory behind a specification-based system is I know how my system is supposed to behave. And so I will write rules which say this is how my system should behave on a normal basis, on an ongoing basis. And so when that model is deviated from, we know there's a problem. So for example, you may have, let's say you have a network A, B, C, and you know, let's say you know A and B talk to each other, and A and C talk to each other, but B and C should never talk to each other. Because A is a server, B and C are clients, and the way your system is set up, only, you know, the client should only be talking to the host. There should be no peer-to-peer interactions. So you can have a specification of your network traffic that says, these are the hosts, and these are the servers in my network. These are the ones who should, connections between, and these are the clients. The clients should talk to the servers, and the servers can talk to the clients. The servers may talk to each other. The clients never talk to each other. Simple. And then you could detect, oh, wow, that's a rogue network connection. That's a specification. We're not detecting weirdness. We're not detecting, you know, people say, B and C should never talk to each other. Someone might have installed a peer-to-peer client, or someone might be trying to attack this one, or whatever. But you know, that shouldn't be happening. It doesn't matter why it would happen. Similarly, you can have specifications for the nature of the protocol between systems, saying, this is a spec of my application's data protocol, and if someone violates the spec, yo-ho, get out of here. And you could potentially have the spec be much tighter than what might be the original spec. You can say, in our network, we never use this option. So like, if I see a packet with this option flag signal turned on or something, well, we never use that, so that's, yeah, that's a problem. So this is ways you can detect, you know, forged packets, or you could detect someone trying to send invalid input to a web, to an application of some kind. There's lots of ways in which it all depends on the granularity of your specification. The more precisely, at the, you know, the limit, you specify the exact behavior of every program on your entire network. In practice, specification-based intrusion detection do not have that level of model, but the more effort you put into building a sophisticated model, the more types of attacks you can detect. So,
and this would be sort of more unique to each person or each network, right?
So now, you see, that's the thing. It's like, what nature of specification are we talking about here? Now, it's one thing to say, okay, there's the specification of what the developer of the original applications had. That's typically not enough to protect a lot, to protect much. What you normally want is a much tighter specification for what is allowed at a particular installation, which gets to the fundamental challenge of specification-based systems, labor. You need to understand your network or understand your host in very fine detail of what should and should not happen. And you have to write down those rules. How many people do you think have any idea how systems work in an organization? Very few. And almost never is the case that someone understands everything. They understand pieces. So to really do this, you'd have to have a whole bunch of people write pieces, parts, and figure out how they all fit together. And then you'd have to keep constantly updating that specification as the nature of your systems change. But most enterprises don't have any idea how their systems behave. I mean, is this a fact? I mean, it's hard. I mean, when you really go down and look at how systems behave, it's complicated. Now, maybe your specification might actually be not at the level of systems, maybe it's a level of users. You know that these users should only be using these applications. But of course, when you really get at these users should only be using these applications, then you start actually getting something that looks like access control. And that's really the line between specification-based intrusion detection and access control is really just a matter of degree. I mean, if you have a full confidence in your model that you're implementing, and you're willing to deny access to resources when you go outside the bounds, it's an access control system. But if your rules are not, you're not quite that confident in them, and you really more if someone deviates, you just want to signal an alarm, something. That's a specification-based intrusion detection system. But again, you're specifying what's allowed and what's not, and you can model any aspect of the system. Anywhere you could think of applying an access control model, you can apply a specification-based intrusion detection system. And the limitation of specification-based intrusion detection is the same as access control models. Nobody likes configuring access control models. I mean, access control is a pain. What people often do is like, oh, I got denied that operation. I'll just enable all permissions. I'll do things as the administrative user. I don't want to be stopped because I have to understand the access control model and understand why the system is saying no to doing something that I am supposed to be able to do. So they just turn it off or bypass it in some other stupid way, which undermines the security of the system. Not because they're mean or malicious or anything else. They're just trying to get their work done. And that's the thing always with computer security that bugs me, is that there's not an appreciation for how people use systems. The field of usable security over the past decade or so has been really trying to fix this. But it's working against the tide. And you kind of see, like, you know, signatures, like, this assumes that there's some really knowledgeable set of people who can generate all these signatures, and specification-based systems assume there's some knowledgeable people that know exactly how these systems behave and write down the rules and stuff. It's like, where are those people? Even if you bring in someone who's an expert in writing those rules, they won't know your systems. I mean, this is certainly, a signature-based system is certainly more scalable, because you can have a small group of experts examine the malware and they go like, okay, I can write those rules. Specification-based, you gotta go to every organization. I mean, you could have it on your home network. But, you know, if you had someone smart enough, I mean, you all could potentially implement some sort of specification-based system on your network. In fact, that might be a good experience to try doing something like that. But it's not simple. Oh, by the way, if you're looking at what are the concrete things for implementing these, there's two very well-known open source packages for implementing these two philosophies. So signatures and a network skillet. It's Snort. What a great name, Snort. And then what another great name for specification-based? Bro. I didn't make up these names. Bro is a great signature-based system, specification-based system, and Snort is a great signature-based system. Now, it turns out Bro can actually use Snort signatures, because, of course, if you're doing specifications, a signature, you can kind of like shoehorn in there. But so Bro can kind of do it all, though, but it really wants to use specifications, but Snort is more popular for reasons that kind of should make sense given what I just explained. Yes.
Are they acronyms or
backronyms? I think Bro. I mean, I think, yeah, I forget what it stands for, but yeah. Anyway, so certainly, if you want an experience, go and play with one of these systems, set them up on a network, and try to see what they do. Have fun with it. Yeah. As I said, I think there's definitely application for both of these kinds of systems in certain, in certain environments, as long as your expectations are reduced. You're going to have a cost to using things, and the benefit is going to be limited. Because again, with a specification-based system, how hard is it for the attacker to get around your specification? If you have a really precise specification, really hard. In practice, your specification is probably kind of loose. So the attacker getting around it's not so hard.
Just out of curiosity, would IP tables be intrusion detection then? Because you are specifying exactly.
So IP tables is normally considered a firewall.
Right.
And again, really, firewall is kind of network level access control.
Right.
Because it's blocking things and not allowing. This is why it's like, I was trying to talk more about the principles, because you realize these systems aren't doing that much that's different, it's just doing it at different levels. It's like, okay, I've got rules, I say yes or no, what data am I looking, am I analyzing for the rules, and am I able to say yes or no? You know, this, we're actually getting to a little bit of weirdness here, because here we're gonna get not yes or no, going maybe? That's what an alarm is. I think there's something up. Go, human, pay attention to it. I don't know. How are we doing time-wise?
Actually, what time is it? Actually, I can't realize I can't tell the time. Okay, there, 10:50. Okay, I've got time.
So, in the last half an hour, then comes anomaly detection. So now anomaly detection is this whole other world. And the whole other world is saying, is on this weird concept almost. It's it's almost philosophical saying, what's normal? And then, is abnormal bad? You know, in some sense, much of our political rhetoric today is all about how being weird is okay, and that we don't want to have people who are their own special snowflakes. You know, think about gender identity. Most people identify as one or the other, and then you go like people who don't identify. But it's like traditionally like, well, you know, you don't fit in those boxes where you're just out here. But now we're saying, no, yes, they are not part of the standard binary paradigm, but we shouldn't discriminate against them. So in some sense, with anomaly detection, we're saying, well, no, we want to look for that, and we want to discriminate against it. Because it's weird. But weird in a computer sense is bad. Because it's all about context. I mean, in this environment, weird, like someone coming in with, you know, a fluorescent shirt with blinking lights would be a bit weird. Because you don't see that every day, and certainly you don't see that in class. But is it really dangerous? Not really. So if we're thinking about anomaly detection, what we really want is danger detection. We don't actually want to detect anomaly. We want to detect something that is weird. We don't even care about it being weird. We just care about it being dangerous. And so when you think about anomaly detection, what we're really trying to approximate is dangerous with weird. Which, of course, we know is wrong. That's not true. So we have to define our notion of weird in a way such that it will align with dangerous in some way. And does that mean we can't be concerned with all weirdness? We have to almost like narrow ourselves in how we look at things. And it's just similar. We do this all the time. It's like someone walking in with weird clothes is like weird, but not with it. Someone walking in with a bazooka is a different kind of weird. It's like it's an object in hand that's not a laptop or phone. It's something that people don't normally carry around, and it's dangerous. So there's anomaly detection and there's danger. Now, maybe we are, you know, if you're, you know, ROTC or something, it may be normal for you to meet up together and carry around guns. In other situations, that would be considered dangerous, but no, this would be, it's okay. So it's a fluid definition. It depends on context. So in some sense, what ideally we would like to do is have the computer understand whether it's in danger and protect itself. That's the kind of full biological view of things. But that would require us to define the problem, and we don't understand the problem. So how do you define the problem you don't understand? You don't. You have to define it in terms of things you do. And that's why, I mean, that's really why most of the computer security has always focused on specifications or signatures. I mean, really, that's sort of a general thing. And most things in how we do defenses, they're either specifications of system behavior or they're signatures of behavior. They're either whitelist or blacklist. And anomaly detection is kind of somewhat something else. It's, you're trying to define things that are not well defined. And that is the strength, and that is the challenge of doing anomaly detection. So now it's time to talk about a little history. So the first proposals for intrusion detection actually were anomaly-based systems. And they were in the late 70s. It's Ross Anderson. Anderson is the one. I'd have to check the early intrusion detection ones. But in the late 70s, U.S. military, I think it was Air Force, I have to look up the technical report. They had a problem. Their problem was they had computers that had high value information on them. And they knew that some people, like spies, might try accessing those computers and try extracting that sensitive information. Now, there was all this work already on access control and saying, okay, let's have multi-level security, multi-level secure systems. I haven't talked about MLS, have I? I should just talk about that for a second. So MLS, the idea is that it's like, think of mandatory access control. So it's rules you can't change from the system, but you have this notion of some users are fundamentally more privileged than others, and you're worried about not so much the privileges involved in what access is not like, oh, I can do operations with files. It's more, what can I see? And so you have, unclassified, secret, top secret. Of course, it goes higher or something like that. But so let's say you have some information that is top secret. Well, let's say I have a user that's cleared to access top secret information. They should also be able to access secret and unclassified information. Now, let's say they're putting together a report and they're using information that's top secret. So now that the documents that are created should then have the label of top secret. Even if, but it could be that almost the entire document is unclassified except for one sentence. And that one sentence in this 50-page report now labels the entire report as being top secret. So the multi-level security community was always about, okay, well, how are we going to label documents properly? How do we make sure of it? And then how do we worry about people leaking information? Let's say an attacker gets control of an account in top secret. Now, if it's a top secret account, it's going to have all these rules about how it can send out things. Like, it might not even be able to send out email or be able to do other network communications, but maybe the unclassified folks can. So maybe they're going to try leaking information between this. And so the process running with the maximum, with top secret is going to try to communicate with an unclassified one and send messages. And so you got to block the information. Well, you can't make no friends send messages. Well, now what if they start consuming resources and looking at timing attacks and stuff? And now you've got a covert channel and they can all talk to each other. Silly. It gets arbitrarily complicated in a way that's very fun to analyze, and in practice you would never actually build a system like this because you could never analyze and understand what was going on and how many security guarantees. There's a lot of fun theoretical things of saying you can't actually do this, or if you're going to do this you have to restrict things. Yeah. Look it up, it's kind of interesting. It actually has some interesting applications, this sort of thing, to virtual machine security. Because if you think of the relationship between different virtual machines and what they can communicate, and you think about them having secrets, and you're talking about the underlying host operating system and stuff, some of it kind of looks like a multi-level security system. But anyway, the reason why I mentioned this is people were thinking about security. They were thinking about these very important things, and they were thinking about spies getting into these computers. And they realized this was all like, this ain't going to cut it, because they're going to find a way around this. What do we do? They want, and so the way you would normally do this is you would have audit. This was the first kind of approach. This is similar to financial audits. What's a financial audit? It's that you have records of financial transactions. You have that, okay, this, a check was written here, money went here, it's all your ledgers and stuff, where you can keep track of your money. And so what happens in an audit is you go through the books and make sure everything makes sense. Is all the money accounted for? Is everything labeled properly? And the idea is that if an organization has goes through an audit and they pass the audit, then you at least know, okay, they're not doing funny things with the books. Because if you want to do something illegal, which generally you have to do is you have to hide your money. You have to hide the trail. You can't let anyone see, oh, you spent money for, you spent money on, buying drugs. That's probably not allowed. And then you sold those drugs in order to fund your new project. That's probably not allowed. But if you do special things with your accountant, you might be able to hide that. Maybe you can obfuscate it to such a way that an accountant is going, oh, no, it looks okay. Because they use names that look kind of legitimate and stuff until you actually track it down. But then there's this whole area of forensic accounting, which goes through and tries to look for cooked books, as the term is. So books, you know, bookkeeping that's been messed up. So the history of audit goes back a long way. It's primarily financial. So when computers came along and computers were big and expensive, people thought, why not do the same thing with computers? Let's audit them. And so you have audit, would produce audit trails, where the computer would log all of the key activities. It's like, when did someone log into the system? Where did they log into the system? When did they log out? Oh, what, you know, what systems do they access? What, you know, applications do they use? You know, and all the important things about what they were doing on the system. They would generate this audit trail. But of course, computers are very good at producing things like that in great volume. It's basically a fancy log, right? This is log files. What is supposed to happen traditionally is a human, maybe a security officer, should go through the audit logs and look for bad things happening. Apply human-level pattern recognition to the events coming off the computer and say, whoa, someone is trying to do something bad. And they won't have full certainty, but that would allow them to initiate an investigation, saying, I think you need to, let's take you aside. Or maybe they get a tip somewhere else that this person may be selling secrets or something, and so they then look at the history of their activity and then see if there's anything suspicious there. So maybe the audit trail isn't necessarily reviewed on a daily basis, but if there's any other reason for suspicion, it's a way of going back and saying, oh, what things have they touched? Again, this is all like classic audit, but instead of talking about money, you're talking about things on your computer. But being a good computer scientist, you should look at this going like, that doesn't seem right. Humans looking through data and analyzing it for patterns. That sounds really painful, error-prone, and boring. So we don't want to do that. So anomaly detection, anomaly-based intrusion detection, really started as statistical analysis of audit logs. You're just going to look through the audit log and look for patterns. Is someone logging in more frequently than they should, logging in from weird places and stuff? You just compute a whole bunch of statistics for whatever measures you can think of in the audit trail, and then you look at those, and then you kind of tell when, oh, look, that measure has changed. And maybe you kind of think like, okay, well, what's the, you know, we should look at how often they log in, or look at how many bytes they've transferred, and how many they've saved, or they'll just come up with a bunch of measures. They'll make a profile of user behavior. They'll look for some deviation in that statistical profile from their standard measures and then say, okay, that's someone suspicious. They're out, you know, there's so many sigmas out of our model. So many standard deviations off of our average or whatever. And then, you know, that's a pretty rare event. We assume normality. You know, let's go investigate it. Seems okay, right? It's not so okay. Why is it not so okay?
You still need a person to look at stuff.
Well, yeah. The idea of this, you know, kind of stat space audit trail analysis is that it's supposed to do data reduction. I mean, yes, a person has to interpret it. At the end of the day, most intrusion detection system probably wants a human in the loop. That's not fatal. But it's, I'm looking for something else.
Can the human keep up with how much activity that's going on?
Well, that's why you're having the program in there to handle the statistical analysis.
No, but I meant to actually audit and look at everything else.
No, I mean, if you do a manual audit, yeah, humans can't keep up with that. And that's the idea of doing the audit anomaly detection on audit role.
Yes.
I guess a lot of standard operations, such as like new user, new files, new activities, can generate anomalies when they're not actually things that would be considered as abnormal behaviors.
So the false alarm problem is certainly a key part of this. That's what it is. But of course, you could think of adjusting your stats and say, like, okay, no, but if this user is doing this, then it should be fine or something, you know, some way of cross-correlating or something. You have to add in rules to deal with those kind of exceptions. I'm thinking of the fundamental issue here is people. That's the real problem. You're trying to do statistical analysis of human behavior, fundamentally. Filtered through the lens of a program, but at a very coarse granularity of just operation stuff. And to fully understand that what the humans are doing, you have to understand what the humans are doing. I mean, it's one thing for a security officer to sit there and look through it, and they understand human behavior, and they go like, oh yeah, you know, this guy's, you know, got sick, and so he's working from home, and that's why he's, you know, there's all these transfers here, or this person's on a special assignment from over there, and that's why they're sending all the data to Taiwan or something. I mean, a human can integrate all this contextual information for knowing who people are and what they're doing, and can use that to help understand the change in the statistical profile. But if a computer's looking at it, how's it going to figure out anything? I mean, it's just going to see things that deviate from baseline. It's just going to say, oh, that's weird. And it's going to generate a lot of false alarms. But the false alarms comes from the fact that the computer is trying to analyze a problem for which it does not have enough information. It doesn't have enough domain-specific information, doesn't have enough, it can't see everything, it's seeing only when the system is being used. And the anomalies really come from all these other factors that might as well be random from the perspective of the statistical analysis. So you can say stats isn't good enough. Let's use more sophisticated things. Let's use rules. Let's use some fancy machine learning. Let's, you know, use a neural network. But it doesn't matter, because you can only learn what's there. And there's a lot of stuff that isn't there. Now, what's the today's solution for solving this sort of problem? Give me more data. Like, could I connect the audit log with all of the social network activity of all employees and all internal email? And, you know, can I get every data source I can and integrate them all together into this super system which will analyze everything? It's kind of what the intelligence organizations are trying to do, or have been doing. And I will say, at a fundamental level, if you care about security, that's dumb. It's just dumb. It just makes no sense. Because now you're trying to model the world. You have to model everything in order to understand anything. And as you know, if you have to try understanding everything to understand anything, you understand nothing. The only way we understand anything in this life is by limiting the scope of what we look at. And the trick always is, how do you appropriately limit the scope for the problem you're trying to address? That's the hard part. Audit trails were designed with humans in mind. I mean, they're typically designed to be relatively concise, even though they still produce way too much information. But they're designed for a human auditor to look through and have high-level semantic events that they can then go like, okay, this is what's going on. At that level, the only kind of anomalies that can be detected are ones that humans would understand with bringing in all their domain knowledge. And a computer can detect some of that, but simple statistical analysis or even sophisticated machine learning just doesn't have the data to see what's going on. And it's crazy pants and think you can integrate all the information that you need and actually process it in the same way.
But, and if you did, you'd know everything about the person anyway, and you wouldn't, what security would they have?
Yeah, well, that leads to other problems. But this notion that we can, that having all the information on someone means you can understand them,
is also a fallacy. I mean, for God's sakes, we all have people in our lives that we know all kinds of crazy things about. You know, we've known them for years, we know them in all these intimate ways, and they still surprise us all the time. If someone you know well doesn't surprise you all the time, you're not paying attention. Because people are complicated. They do all kinds of things. You know, you can't predict. Can you predict whether they're going to laugh at this joke or not? I mean, you might be able to predict it some of the time, but sometimes you're going to say, you're going to be completely wrong. And this is for humans trying to understand humans. And I'm sorry, we do not have the algorithms for even beginning to understand human intelligence. I don't care what Elon Musk is saying. We are so, so far away from that. It's like, no.
So how do you detect anomalies without having some sort of model of allowed behavior?
So anomaly detection is about models. It is about learning. But it's not about learning everything. It's not about modeling everything. It's about, to do this well, you do the opposite. You have to limit your scope in a way such that you actually have a sane chance of modeling it. It's something the computer can understand. So the question is, what can the computer understand? Computers do not understand humans, but computers might be able to understand programs. That really is kind of the basis of what much of my early work is. Don't detect weird users, detect weird programs or weird program behavior. Now you might say, well, why is this interesting? Now this isn't necessarily, this isn't about solving the entire problem. This is about solving part of the problem. What part of the problem can we detect? We aren't necessarily going to, it's a question of, can we detect weird users? Maybe. Maybe not. That's a secondary thing. What could we detect is programs behaving weird. That does imply a lot of security problems. What's a program that's been compromised by a buffer overflow? It's behaving pretty weird. What's someone using a backdoor in a program? That's pretty weird. You know, all kinds of things, security level violations that happen in a program are not the way the program normally behaves. They're weird.
So if we've narrowed the scope down this far, like what's the difference between this and an anti-malware at this point?
Anti-malware is normally either heuristics on, oh, this is malicious behavior, or signatures of, yeah, this is definitely malicious behavior. And this isn't. This is anomaly detection. This is learning how the program behaves in practice. It's not a specification. It's not a signature. It's a model based on training. You learn how the program behaves.
What's to stop someone from compromising the anomaly detection software? And then you run into this, turtles all the way down.
That is certainly a concern for any kind of system. You have to figure out how you're going to, this is actually an active area of active research right now, is determining what can you trust and how do you think about that. One thing we normally think of, so I talked about trusted computing base, right? The idea that you have this thing that all your access control or whatever the rules are based on this little bit of code. If you can make that right, everything, all your security properties hold. So if you're talking about any security mechanism, you go like, well, how much of the system do I have to count on actually working in order for the system to maintain security. And that is a factor in this. I'll talk about, you can think a bit about where you should put this.
there's some obvious places. But yeah, that's a factor. But let's not think about the protecting the mechanism first. Just think about, what do we want to do? And I'm saying that programs are easier to understand than humans, because the computer, by its nature, has everything about the program it's got. Okay, you have a program binary, you have inputs, and it produces outputs. That's the program. That's the beautiful thing about computers, right? You fully understand what they do. You can't fully understand what you do, there's some problem, and you debug it until you do understand what it does. Now, you might say programs can be complicated. They can be big programs. They can take lots of input. They can do lots of different things, but it's an understandable problem. It should be able to be modeled because everything is in scope. Everything can be observed. So in principle, we're in much better shape than trying to understand humans. Humans are in some sense outside the system. We only see a small fraction of what's going on with them. Program behavior is in scope. Now, you could think about program behavior as on a single host, or you could think of it in a distributed context of many programs talking to other computers and on whole. But still, the focus is on programs, not people. And that we can understand those things, and then we can decide how to, you know, then we might be able to certainly figure out what's weird, and then maybe from weird, we can move to what's dangerous. And distinguish those sets.
Before I... Are we about our time? Yeah, I think I'm out of time. Yeah, I'm out of time.
Perfect. Okay, so for Wednesday, so start looking at the questions. I think I'm going to maybe add like one more to the assignment, then we finalize. Deadlines, we're on... So when is the next one? When did I say it was supposed to be due? In a week, I think.
Monday.
Was it on Monday? So it's in a week. I'd like to try keeping it for Monday. I can maybe move there, but I'm going to try making a short assignment, and it's really about the stuff I'm talking about this week. So I think it should be doable because, you know, I need to get another grade in there. We could do it a drop, but I think you want more grades. So we'll see. We'll talk Wednesday.
Thank you.